Hi, I'm Natalie Gochner. You are listening to Both Sides of the Aisle. I represent the political center and have on the political left, Shireen Gourbani.
Hello, and hi to the listeners.
And on the right, Dan McKay. Hi, Dan.
Hey, everybody.
The session is going on, but we're going to go to Washington, D.C., and we're just going to step back for a minute, talk about COVID, and talk about what it's doing to U.S. life expectancy, which has fallen by one full year in 2020. I know enough about demographic research to know that small changes in life expectancy are hugely significant. Shireen, your commentary.
Yeah, so I have to say I'm grateful to see our flags across this country and across the state lowered to half staff when we think about losing over 500,000 Americans, when we think about the almost 2,000 Utahns. I think we're at 1,820 individuals that we've lost here in this state. The data and the research I've been really interested in is the stuff around psychic numbing, that it's hard for us to really process these numbers, to really engage with what this means. But when we really think about sort of the localized impacts that, you know, individuals that have lost someone, a partner, a brother, a sister, all of those impacts in families, but then we pull back and look at, you know, from a demographer's perspective, thinking about what this means in the context of just our overall life expectancy, and especially what it's meant in communities of color, there's a devastating impact. And it's one that I think we really have to reckon with.
Yeah. Dan, the data is showing that Black Americans, their life expectancies dropped by 3 years. Sad statistic.
Well, it's actually, if you take the Hispanic population and the Black population together, it's like 4.1 years, right? So it's actually over four, which doesn't tell a better story, but it does show, you know, that the pandemic has definitely impacted male population and the minority population greater than it did everybody else, right? And so, you know, that's a pretty telling story. And it's kind of consistent, really, with what we know about our workforce, too, right? And Shireen has covered this before, and I thought this is a great point. You know, it's easier for the quote-unquote, you know, middle class and above to social distance. Their jobs are easier, more transmittable that way with technology versus, you know, if you're in a labor position, that is not easier. And so, you know, there's that issue to kind of deal with as well.
Yeah. Dan, I know you've spent a lot of time in Washington, D.C. They had the National Cathedral, the bells there, toll 500 times on Monday to commemorate the 500,000 people who've died in the last year. So, wow, it's a national tragedy, and I hope we're getting past it. Let's jump to some other kind of news in Washington. The White House unveiled a new immigration bill. It has an 8-year path to citizenship, Dan, and I don't know how you feel about it. I wondered what you think. We have 11 million undocumented immigrants in our country. What do you think of Biden's new bill?
You know, I think you're going to see a lot of change on the immigration format. I mean, I think especially when you look at Congress has been largely inactive. And so seeing, you know, push changes, those kinds of things, it's still not like, you know, it's not necessarily bipartisan yet. And so hopefully we're going to see that. We so far have not seen those efforts really, like those promises really play out. But I'm hopeful that we'll be able to shape the bill in a way that will, you know, create more bipartisan support.
I love it. Dan, I heard an open mind there and a common ground middle. So that I'm with you. Shireen, your comment on the immigration proposal.
Yeah, so I think this is clearly long overdue. And while we might not have, you know, full bipartisanship in our in Congress, what we do know is that most Americans believe that it is beyond time that we start getting some really practical solutions for a lot of people in this country. And there are lots of ways I think that we can do this. There are many ways that we can move to a much more humane and much more an immigration policy that's much more reflective of the promise of what this country offers.
Okay, I want to go to Donald Trump's tax returns, and I'm just going to use a couple of words here, phrases. Dan, I'll go to you first. Grand jury, Manhattan District, hush money, Stormy Daniels, Michael Cohen, and the notion that perhaps Trump illegally accounted for his hush money as a legal expense. I think this portends trouble for the former president. Why are you giggling, Dan?
How do I react to that statement, Natalie? It's like, I think this doesn't show. Sorry. Maybe I'm so late in the session that when you say something like that, that was not where I was expecting your statement to go. I'm sorry.
Well, I was trying to connect for the listeners that it's a grand jury, it's Manhattan, and then it gets back to Stormy Daniels and hush money. But the issue is the tax treatment of that money, Shireen.
Yeah, so I would just say that I think this is the beginning of what is likely to be, in potentially many states, some real legal troubles for Donald Trump. So I think this is just the beginning. And frankly, it's just a pretty deep reflection of what I think most Americans, whether they liked him or not, understood was happening.
Dan is a crack up. He's crying. He's laughing so hard he had to mute himself. But Dan, your response, what would the right say about a former president that's in this trouble?
I'm just going to say that it doesn't show well for the president, the former president. And I did read about 45 bills today. So I did not keep track of the latest Democratic effort to throw another pile of dirt on the Donald J. Trump presidency. That said, look, people. Be honest, don't, pay off people and then not do things right on your taxes. It doesn't show well for anybody. It's just a pro tip. It's just between you and me and everybody listening.
Yeah. And it's also probably good if you pay a little bit.
Surgeons
should
general.
Be consequences. So
it's actually 5 out of 6 dentists. It's the same dentists who recommend Crest toothpaste also recommend paying a little bit of taxes.
But I do think, I mean, Dan, I know that you're saying that this is an agenda by Democrats, but I really do think that this is deeply troubling, and it has been the whole time. And many of us, I think, across the political spectrum can see that. So I do hope that we have some accountability when really we couldn't count on Republicans in the Senate to deliver accountability when they showed up.
Mind my words. I'm in a, Bush, I will follow George H.W. Bush. Read my lips. If the Democrats don't leave Donald J. Trump for the next 4 years, you will see a 4-year term for President Biden, and that will be the end of the Democratic
administration. So you can read my lips, because I do think that it might be the biggest favor that my party could do for yours
is to have some sense
of accountability for a person who clearly was working outside of what the legal limits were.
There you go.
Hey, let's go to Vice President Harris just to kind of round it out. She's basically saying that the women leaving the workforce is a national emergency in the time of COVID. Apparently, there's been about 2.5 million women who have dropped out of the workforce. That's really, to use a Shireen term, deeply troubling because, when you drop out of the workforce, you lose career trajectory, you lose seniority, you lose years of service. There's all sorts of things. There's more barriers to get back in.
Yeah.
And they're calling it a she session or the pink collar recession. It's women who have left the workforce to care for children, to homeschool. Shireen, I'll go to you.
Yeah. So I think this is concerning on many levels. Of course, we're seeing a national trend. And I will just say there's been excellent reporting in many publications around women exiting the workforce and really the challenges that the families and in particular women are having as they're shouldering the burden of, keeping families afloat, running school from home, caring for elderly, parents. There's so much going on, I think, in this pandemic that has really just exposed problems that were already existing. We knew that there were deep racial inequities in our health system, and we're seeing that just in a way that we cannot deny. In the same way, there have been deep challenges for women in the workforce, and the pandemic has only really put a light on that.
Yeah. Dan, you're a businessman. You're an attorney. You're a legislator. You see
a
lot.
I'm a pain in the butt is what I am. To be very honest.
We'll save that for the second segment. But Dan, what would you say to our listeners is going to be the post-COVID world? I mean, I'm keeping a list that we're less globalized. We're more digitized. We're less equal. We consume products closer to home. I mean, I got this whole list of things that I'm kind of tracking and following, but What are you seeing as life after COVID?
I always struggle. It's an interesting question, right? And even like losing women in the workforce, like women, we saw this in economic reports early. I think it was like third quarter, fourth quarter last year, you know, that female dominated industries like hospitality, education, entertainment, you know, those areas specifically saw an unhealthy impact as a result of COVID and the pandemic. And so, you know, add that to the losses in the healthcare system and those redirections. I think when you take all of those things combined with the fact that you also have a population that is refocusing itself on things that matter the most, and you still had a lot of, you know, good, bad, or indifferent, people were delaying their childbirthing years, but here you are, you know, and there's still a lot of women who would like to have families. And so you have a period of time where everybody's, you know, kind of expecting some things to be down, to be different. And you also have women starting families too, as another component of leaving the workforce. And then to Shireen's point, you also have, you know, the more efficient, you know, the families making the more efficient decision economically about women being the lower income earner. And as a result, they would leave to, you know, to be the primary caregiver as opposed to the husband. So all of those questions, I think, are going to play themselves out over time. What I'm hopeful, and this is just me, I'm really hopeful that we have a new generation of moms, and that we as a workforce and as a state, as a country, that we figure out ways to have better job integration so that we have more flexibility to take advantage of some of these great, you know, women, professional women who are able to, you know, bring a lot of value and not have, you know, not require an in-person meeting, right? At some 1 hour away location where, you know, it creates all these problems. So I'm hopeful that we'll learn those lessons, right?
I think there's a real opportunity here for employers to, I think, as we have said before, nobody looks good in a pandemic, right? But I think there's a huge opportunity for a lot of people to look really good, considering the decisions that people might make in this time, men, women, whatever, who are taking different roles in their family life. I think we should all enter into looking at resumes with a little bit of grace.
You got it. Natalie Gochner in the Political Center. I'm with Shireen Gourbani on the left, Dan McKay on the right. In our next segment, we're going to walk through a lot of legislative bills on Capitol Hill. Stay tuned, everyone.
You're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle on KCPW. For more episodes of all our in-house podcasts, click on the Local Programs tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider donating to KCPW to support public radio in your community.
Shireen Gourbani on the left.
Dan McKay on the right.
Natalie Gochner in the Political Center. This is Both Sides of the Aisle. The legislature's in session. It's the waning hours. And I'm really pleased to share with listeners, it's been reported in the media, but the legislature is giving $100 million tax cut. It's slated for Utah veterans, for seniors, for families. It comes from having about a $1.5 billion budget surplus. Dan, we're going to go to you first. You chair Rev and Tax up on Capitol Hill. It's a powerful committee. What should our listeners look forward to?
Well, you know, we are in a balancing act, and I think, you know, Natalie, it would be interesting, really. I an economist asking me what I think about the, you know, the numbers in the state is also comical. I'm not really sure what you're setting me up for here, Natalie, but what I can say is that there are a lot of questions about how long term and how permanent this revenue is, and how much of it is a result of federal stimulus performance, and those kinds of questions. And so that balancing act, as we're trying to kind of balance the budget here towards the end, is a really interesting dynamic on the Hill right now. And we've had several conversations about the budget and trying to figure, you know, the last time we had a budget this big or a surplus this big, we actually like didn't spend it on anything other than really stabilizing, you know, and rehabbing and rebuilding the Capitol. Was the last time
I was up
and
there
I think
for that?
You were there for that.
I was there. I remember it very well. We had so much money, and we thought, "What do we do that's good?" And we you know, fixed our Capitol to withstand an earthquake. But Dan, I appreciate you, you know, recognizing that this is an area that I do a lot of work in. But you know, the thing I would say is, the fiscal stimulus, the federal stimulus, the CARES Act, was about 22% of Utah's gross domestic product. That's how much came in. So that is an unbelievable, that at one time in our economy, in the second quarter, June, July, that one in every $4 going through the economy was basically just a gift. So Shireen, you've got to like that there's, you know, what they're talking about, and Dan can give more detail, but not having an income tax on military retirement pay, eliminating income tax on some Social Security income. I'm assuming you would like that. What do you think about the overall package?
Yeah, I do like that. I do think that there's a question that you've actually answered previously on this show about why our revenue projections seem to be so robust, right? Or why the actual money coming in is so robust when we think about the revenue projections and really how we're projecting what the budget of the state is going to be and the actual dollars that come in. There's a disconnect there. And I think there's a deeper question to be unraveled in that space. But in terms of what we're seeing for the the family tax credit, the Social Security, as you mentioned, for members of the military, these are all tax cuts that I certainly support. I'm glad to see. But there's some bigger issue here in how we're accounting and really what the numbers are that are coming in.
Yeah, yeah. Dan, I want to do some rapid fire with you just because these are quick bills, but just to see if there's anything to say. It looks like the Senate killed the controversial billboard bill. You're in the Senate. What's the backstory there? This would be
no
SB 144.
Bill dies. Yeah, no bill actually dies, right? And this bill, it died, and then we made a motion and brought it back. And so it's not dead yet. It's just been resurrected and is now sitting on a reading calendar for the sponsor to, you know, try and find some compromise.
I'm going to think some maneuvering going on. Shireen, I'll let you comment on this one as well, but the House bill that would hike fees on electric and hybrid vehicles, looks like that's died, although Dan says they never die. Shireen, you're the EV driver here, but you watching that one?
I am. I'm an EV driver here. And I do also, I think that this is the right move. I certainly believe that we should have to pay electric vehicle drivers, avoid the gas tax, right, which goes back into infrastructure. And I think there needs to be some balance there. But having what was proposed to be the highest in the nation did not seem like the right answer in a place where we also have the worst air quality. So there should be a better balance there.
Mm, interesting. Dan, there's one stuck in Senate Rules Committee. This is HB 278, one you'll know well. This is the Dixie State bill to rename Dixie State University. Oh, my goodness. I think this is an easy call, and yet the legislature is struggling and struggling. Your perspective, Dan?
Well, this is one of those bills that, you're right, it's a no-brainer, and it should be done. The problem is we've taken the name of a university and it's become political. And that's probably the number one sign that, like, your university name might have problems if, when you go to change it, it's got some kind of politics to it beyond just like your sports team, right? So I think when you think about Dixie State and its component, there is a host of folks who are concerned because they own Dixie Auto Repair or Dixie Ice Cream or whatever it might be. And they look at the symbol of changing Dixie and, you know, the acknowledgement that it might be, you know, insensitive or racist or whatever it might be, that changing that then makes them racist because they don't necessarily want to change the name of their business or the high school or go down the list, right? But most people just don't understand. A university's reach, because it's a university and we did that a few years ago, it's just broader than the regional area. And as a result, if you're going to recruit, you're going to do anything else outside of that area, having a name that is objectionable to even 5% of your attractive class doesn't make sense. But hey, let this bill be a reminder that the public does get a say in this process, and they get it through their senators and their representatives. And one vote, one senator can make a difference. And that's what you see here.
I had a conversation with a member of the Regents, the State Board of Regents, and he was just sort of saying, Natalie, what would you do on this? This was several months ago. And I'm like, err on the side of being sensitive to this important issue. Shireen, there's another one. I think it's HJR 13. This is Representative Sandra Hollins. It declares racism a moral and public health crisis.
Considering what we discussed at the top of the show, we understand, I think many people who've really looked at the data around health inequities or understand what's going on when it comes to everything from police brutality to housing inequities to even education disparities, schools that are more diverse. We know that there's a deep-seated problem around racism in our community and how equitable or inequitable our communities are. I'm hopeful to see this move forward. It sounds like it got moved out of committee, which is good to see. But it's also something that's moving forward in our healthcare systems. I mean, just I feel like it was late summer. We had Intermountain and many other University of Utah and other health institutions come out and say racism is a public health crisis. And frankly, the data just backs it up. So we really do need to do more in this space to create a more equitable and just society.
Okay, Dan, I want to talk to you about SB 205. This is your bill that would eliminate the dual path to the primary election ballot. You can imagine I'm really disappointed in this bill. I don't like it. I think SB 54, which was what created the dual path or the signatures to the ballot, provided greater choice, more competition, increased voter engagement and participation. Since 2016, Utah's had the second highest increase in voter participation. What are you up to here? I don't understand. It's very popular.
Let me just unravel 70% what you did starting
of public like it.
So we're obviously number two in voter engagement improvement, and we're the state that implemented full vote by mail, right? And we were the most prepared for vote by mail. Yeah. So everyone says vote by mail actually increases participation.
But then let's go even one more.
And you say if you're looking through all the things that you're parsing through and you're getting greater participation, or you're trying to moderate the legislature or the elected officials, fine, all those things are possible, but the caucus convention process is still nominating 99.6% of the 730 plus elections that we've had. So at the end of the day, we've spent more than $2 million in 3 years gathering signatures because the rich and the wealthy and the incumbents are getting signatures.
Do you have
a
problem
with
that?
Oh, by the way, the one last thing is, the SB 54 has created greater incumbency retention. So we have taken and we have created a model where only the incumbents can be in office.
So damn.
And only the wealthy can get there. Shereen, so I just say let the parties choose. And if you up the threshold, there's going to be more primaries for people to be involved in.
Shereen, you're just going to watch the two Republicans argue here. But Dan, I just have to say, okay, so those are your points. You drop this bill with 10 days left in the session and it goes to the Rev and Tax Committee, you know, out of rules. I mean, it just, to me, it doesn't match process. There's a lot of
people. And SB 54 went to Business and Labor. So don't get too excited about where SB 54, where bills end up. Because what had happened
point,
at the end of the session.
My point is that there's a lot of people that have worked really hard to be a part of election improvements in our state that have done a lot of really good things. More candidates.
We don't have more candidates.
We do.
We have a
look
lot
at
of
the
candidates.
Choice I
we
had. Look at the choice I had in the Republican Party for governor.
And we had nine
John
candidates.
John Huntsman Sr. would not even have been on the primary ballot.
Candidates when John Huntsman Jr. won as the governor, there were nine. And don't forget that Gary Herbert came in eighth place.
So I just have to jump in here because I do feel like, Dan, I have to say a few things. Number one, I do feel like our own Utah version of voter suppression is the suppression of moderate Republicans. And I feel like that's what your bill is trying to do. Secondly, for you to suggest, and I mean this with a heart full of love, that you have a problem with people making money off of signature gathering, I don't understand why you would want to curtail anybody's ability to really step into that space and make money. If they're able to do that as an entrepreneur, as a person who supports that kind of ingenuity, I find that argument deeply disingenuous. And I also have to say, I think that there's something really incredible about the ability of people to go out and have that kind of person-to-person communication. I did not collect 7,000 signatures when I ran for CD2, but I did collect over 3,000. And the work that happened in that door-to-door signature collecting was incredible. I think the work that happened with the tax referendum, the signature collecting that happened there, signature gathering is an important part of what has become the political experience in the state, and I think it's valuable.
And I just think, Dan, what I think is let's have some dialogue with people who brought SB 54 around, who are part of the compromise. You were part of that. Let's involve them and think about how do we make additional improvements. But to wholesale eliminate it.
My phone still works, and I would more than happily answer it.
So again, I think this is the same argument we got into last week. I think that people who want to push forward legislation should go out and have those conversations. You're in the leadership role. You get to control what happens. I think it's important for you to extend the invitation.
Hey, Dan, I can change topic here, but you can sense my disappointment. I don't know what Shireen just gets to watch the Republican Party kind of, you know, get frustrated here. Dan, do you want to?
Well, they're happy because at the end of the day, the other thing the research showed, Natalie, is we're the ones getting, the Republicans are the one turning on themselves in the caucus convention process and the whole fight with SB 54.
All
the
Democrats I know are just living is the dream. We got a really important Senate race coming up with Senator Mike Lee, and we need as many candidates as we can have for people to have the maximum amount of choice and the competition of ideas. Dan, we've got about 15 seconds. I'd love you to pay a tribute and I hope he gets well soon to Tiger Woods. You're a big golfer.
Yeah, I was going to say, man, I hope, Tiger, I know you're listening to the show. I just want you to know, I hope you get better soon and find better things to do than listen to the show.
I'm Natalie Gochner in the Political Center. I'm with Shireen Gorbani and Dan McKay. The program's produced by Anthony Scoma. Thanks for listening, everybody.